I have a story that I want to tell you guys tonight, but I feel a little bit reluctant about it. And I feel that way for two reasons. One is because a lot of the story is rooted in memories of mine from my childhood. And the longer I live, the less trustworthy I find those distant childhood memories to be. So that's one reason. The other reason is that I have a great deal of personal respect for a lot of the main characters in the story. And I've learned to my chagrin on some occasions that podcasts have very long legs. And my perspective on many of the events in this story have shifted quite a bit over time. So I want to be careful. You know, I want to be respectful in telling the story. I think it'll make more sense as we go. I am going to tell it because it's a story that's just kept coming back up for me when I reflect on what we're going to be exploring this evening. So I'm going to tell it and do my best to honor those, you know, those things. Knowing that my parents occasionally listen to these podcasts has been a marvelously tempering thing. So now that's on record as well. Mom, Dad, love you. All right. As most of you know, I grew up in a little northern community, and my parents were founding members of this small Mennonite/community church there. And the more churches that I get to know, the more churches that I get to be in, the more happy I am to have grown up in the one that I did. That was a good little church in an interesting town. It was probably the only, I'm going to, you know, paint with a broad brush here, it was the only non-charismatic, sort of theologically non-charismatic church in town. One of only three or four Protestant churches, period. And this is in an age where, you know, the demarcation of Protestant and Catholic, depending on which side of the demarcation you were on, might have been the demarcation between Christian and non-Christian in a lot of people's minds as well. And so it's just it attracted, long story short, sort of an eclectic community of people to it, because it wasn't sort of culturally anything religious. Like, it certainly, I don't feel like I grew up in a culturally Mennonite church, having been in some of those churches since then. It wasn't that. It was sort of the mellow Protestant church, you know, in town. And so it attracted that kind of whole bunch of people from this little northern community. And if it was anything culturally, it was sort of working class culturally. It kind of had that vibe about it. And my overwhelming sense when I think back on it of what the spirituality of the place was that it was just, I would just use the word genuine or authentic. There wasn't a lot of posing going on. There wasn't a lot of polished upness in this church, which I think is good as well. My dad would have been involved in leadership in this community most of my life. And I can remember as a kid overhearing the occasional conversation between my parents about some issue or other that church leadership was wrestling with. And my recollection is that leadership group was a group of people who were genuinely trying in those moments to discern what the right and best thing was to do in any given situation. I'm not claiming that this is some community that was magically immune from the things that challenged groups of people everywhere. It wasn't. It isn't. But I think it was kind of the real deal. And I'm really grateful for that. At some point, fairly early on in this community, church community's life, there was a family that came into that community that was, well, I think we could probably fairly describe them as a family that were visibly on the margins of the dominant culture. And the dominant culture wasn't, as I said, it wasn't a particularly polished up one. And they were on the margins of that. And I was pretty young. I don't even remember these people's names. But I do remember the uproar. And the reason there was an uproar in the community wasn't sort of an insider-outsider thing so much. It was more because that community was and remains a fairly welcoming place. But the patriarch of this family that came into the community, when I think back on it now, I strongly suspect was someone that was struggling with some fairly serious mental health issues. But to sort of start there and understanding these things, that kind of wasn't the way culture operated then either, you know. And so what we saw was, here was a person who was acting out things in the context of a Sunday morning gathering that were just completely unheard of in that context, and that were, by pretty much any North American standard, unacceptably unkind or aggressive or rude. They were just really quite marked. My memory, as I would describe it now, was that this guy was some kind of a, when he was acting out, he was some kind of a sort of self-styled Old Testament prophet, you know. He was shouting out gloom and doom on the community and pronouncing heresy. And in the middle of, you know, these sort of very ordinary Sunday morning gatherings. And someone who didn't or couldn't respond positively to offered opportunities to take those concerns to a different space for private conversation. That just wasn't working for him. And as I remember it, this community tried hard to make this work. That's my recollection. And they did what we might call, in quotes, Bible-believing folks often do. They opened up their Bibles and they asked themselves, without cynicism and way before anybody thought of putting it on a wristband, what would Jesus do? You know, like, they just really kind of wanted to know what, if Jesus was here, like, and he had to handle this guy and this craziness, what would he do? Because we're kind of trying to live like Jesus, and this kind of doesn't feel like that. So now what, right? And so where do you go when you hit those things, right? What do you do? And as you may have noticed, if you've ever gone searching in the Bible for an answer to a particular problem or insight into a particular specific situation or conundrum, there isn't an index of issues in a corresponding set of verses, right? There's no kind of like, you know, well, in this case, stranger from outside the community who appears to have mental health problems shouting gloom and doom. Like, where is that? You know, like, what would that be under? Is that gloom and doom? Is that prophet? Is that madman? Like, where do you look, even if there was an index? You know, like, what do we do here? And at least, now, I should qualify that idea just a little bit, because at least that used to be the case, that lack of index. I think that, at the risk of letting my cynicism leak out into this community, I think that Bible publishers, like other sorts of struggling folks in print-based industries, have discovered that if you can publish the biblical equivalent of, you know, chicken soup for the Eurocentric privileged colonizing soul, you're going to sell a few more copies of whatever you put under there, you know. So it's happening, right? I mean, you can pick up a version of the Bible for anything. And at any rate, I've never seen a copy of the Bible labeled as its slug, you know, for church leaders in conflicted situations. There probably is one. I just haven't looked for it because the whole idea feels a little, as you may have gathered, less than appealing to me. And it's not that I don't think that the Bible has wisdom for our everyday lives. I do, or I wouldn't waste my time studying it, and I wouldn't waste your time talking about it. I think that is the case. But God knows there's enough advice books out there, in fact, in here, that we could probably just dig around in those, you know, until the room goes dark, and we'd probably have plenty to occupy ourselves with in terms of good advice that we could try to put into practice. But as one author that I read recently put it, handling the Bible is tricky enough without trying to do it while you're wearing the oven mitts of your own theological issues or cultural biases. And a lot of those specific versions feel to me like they come wrapped in their own set of oven mitts. Here, put these on and then handle the Bible. You know, and that's, it's going to behave itself in a certain way. But still, and we've talked about this morning as a community, when we feel like we've come to the end of ourselves, right? Like, it's just, we're just up against it and we just don't know where to go. And we really do care about living ordinary things in a way that might be recognizable to us or to people around us as the way of Jesus, as an actual way, where do we search? Where do we go, right? And so it's a really compelling question. Why isn't this more ordinary? Well, sacred text is certainly part of that search, isn't it? And so is history, and so is relationship, and so is spirit, and so is imagination. And in any event, this person kept coming, and they kept making a ruckus to the point where even though I don't recall ever wondering if my parents were looking out for me in all of this, I do remember feeling afraid. I do remember finding it all quite frightening as a child. And I know that the people that were responsible for leading that community were feeling it too. And I know that they were wondering how to deal with it. And I do recall that their wrestling took them to the text that we're in today, which is why maybe this story kept coming by association back to me and back to me and back to me. And so let me just read this for you. We're kind of working our way through it. This might be mostly for your benefit, but through the parables of Jesus. And this is mostly in Matthew's gospel, not exclusively, but predominantly. And this is one of those chunks in Matthew that sets up a parable that we were going to talk about today. We're not going to make it to the parable, by the way, today. We're going to do that in a couple weeks. Christina's going to tell us some of the story of her reflections on her travels and all of that next Wednesday night. So we can look forward to that. And then we'll come back to this. But the text is Matthew 18, 15 to 22 in this case, which the editors in my translation have labeled dealing with sin in the church. And so this, it's familiar text perhaps to most of us, but let me just read it. If your brother or sister sins, go and point out their fault just between the two of you. If they listen to you, you have won them over. But if they will not listen, take one or two others along so that every matter may be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. If they still refuse to listen, tell it to the church. And if they refuse to listen even to the church, treat them as you would a pagan or a tax collector. Truly, I tell you, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. No, there's a text. And we're not even going there. Again, truly, I tell you that if two of you on earth agree about anything they ask for, it will be done for them by my Father in heaven. For where two or three gather in my name, there am I with them. Editors inserted here the parable of the unmerciful servant, which is, or unforgiving servant, which is the parable we're headed for. These verses follow. Then, after Jesus says all this, Peter came to Jesus and asked, Lord, how many times shall I forgive my brother or sister who sins against me? Up to seven times? And Jesus answered, I tell you, not seven times, but 77, or 70 times seven. This is a pretty thorough transition between a couple of parables. There's a lot of really kind of weighty, meaty stuff in here. And it needs to be explored because when I talked in the blurb about the shiny thing, I got an email from Jonathan. Okay. I don't know if you guys ever read those things, but I made a crack at the end about our room above the Vera Wang picture frames. Mm-hmm. He says, thanks for the plug for the Vera Wang picture things. Nice take on shiny thing, given where you know where you're headed. Sorry, yeah. Sorry, John. It's irresistible. The shiny thing in the text, in this text, that has distracted the church historically from the bigger and far more important mission of receiving and passing along the unconditional forgiveness of God, the shiny thing here is this question of forgiveness. Or, as the text seems to have it, the question of unforgiveness. If we're going to put it back into the metaphor of the blurb from the week, this text is like the credit card advertisement with the LED, and it's lodged front and center in the place that sells the bagels that we really need to get for lunch. Like it's like the blinking thing that we can't ignore, that if we could just get our head away from it and look at the context, we'd realize where it belongs. And so that's kind of what I want to try to do a little bit of in the rest of this time. Little reminder of where we're coming from in terms of what Jesus has just been talking about, because that's really important when you do this kind of thing. So last week, and just preceding this moment in Matthew, we were poking around in the parable of the lost sheep. And just in case you weren't here, or if you were here and you were just thinking with all of your might about which fringe show to choose from, just a reminder. In that parable, like in the one before it, which is about the temple tax and the fish with the coin in its mouth, in both those parables, Jesus makes it absolutely clear that when it comes to forgiveness, forgiveness has nothing to do with merit. Zero, zip, zilch, nada, nothing. The coin is inert. The lost sheep is an idiot. In a high-profile story like the prodigal son, where the prodigal can't even get the first word of his carefully formulated confession out of his mouth before his father runs to him and takes him in his arms and kisses him. There's just no earning going on in these stories when it comes to forgiveness. In none of the parables that have to do with the question of forgiveness do the surrogates for God wait for repentance or reform or, frankly, for any response at all. Not one. All it takes to qualify forgiveness in those stories of Jesus is death. Like, that's it. That's death from the sin that caused it in the first place and that everyone will face. That's the qualifier. That's it. That's the pass key for forgiveness. Well, Jesus kind of has in those stories this growing understanding and his own journey to the extremity of death is going to take care of everything else. So that's why there doesn't need to be a higher qualifier, if you will. Because that journey to that extremity is what's going to deal with everything else. His death and resurrection. So he's kind of like this is dawning on him as he tells the story. So when we do get to the parable of the unforgiving servant, we're going to find those same themes. And they're going to come out in that parable absolutely clear. again. But in the verses that precede it, the ones we just read, they don't. Those themes are not abundantly clear in that text. In fact, it almost feels like the opposite of that. We'll get to that. Back to that childhood story for just a moment. The leadership of the church that I grew up in took the text that I just read, and I think they did their level best to follow the script. I think they really did. They went to this individual in person and in private. They went as a team and in private to no avail, and so staying with the text as a guide, they brought it up in the context of community. And in my childhood recollection, that's when all hell broke loose. I don't remember the words, but I do remember standing at the bottom of the stairs that exited the sanctuary while the cops escorted a still-shouting man and his family out of the building. And I think I could still take you to that chunk of painted concrete that I was standing on. This is a pretty indelible memory. When I was reflecting on this, this may sound egregious, and maybe it is. You judge. But when I was reflecting on this, the mental image that came to mind was of old photographs that I've seen of hangings, public hangings, and how I'm always astonished when I look at those photographs that there are children there witnessing these things. So what's happening this weekend? Well, there's a hanging. Love those things. It's like an entertainment event. And then the more I thought about it, the more I thought, maybe that's not so bizarre. Maybe it's not such a huge cultural remove after all. Maybe my connection isn't that egregious. All I have to do to put it into 21st century context is go to the movie theater and watch kids sitting there watching things where I go, really? But still, there is something about what I witnessed in those events that distresses me, and it sends me back to the text, and it makes me wonder what that niggling thing in my spirit is. And what I want to offer are some thoughts, not as a critique of that story or of that community, because I believe what I've said about that community's integrity, but as my own further and obviously incomplete reflections on the whole conundrum, because it's a knotty one. The shiny thing in this text that we just read is, to put it simply, the shiny thing is repentance as a condition of forgiveness. That's the blinking LED, the thing we can't seem to look away from. The bagel, the life-giving thing that is also in this story, is the idea of forgiveness without conditions. And that's what Jesus has been hammering away at in all those preceding parables. That's the setup for this whole thing. If we read the same text, the parallel text in Luke, it would seem even more plausible that repentance is the price for entry for forgiveness, that you have to repent first if you want to be forgiven. In Luke, it's a terribly abrupt text because he doesn't include the parable of the unforgiving servant that follows it, and he doesn't include the lead-up that Matthew does either. He just kind of plunks this thing about three strikes and you're out in there. So we're going to take the more complex, but I think arguably more complete story as Matthew tells it this evening. That's the one we're going to work with. So Jesus is just wrapped up, as we head into this text that I read, he is just like the verse before, he's just wrapped up the parable of the lost sheep, and the way he's wrapped it up is by saying, in the same way, your Father in heaven is not willing that any of these little ones should be lost. And that's how he closes off that parable. So as we've talked about when we explored that parable, the little ones, little, lost, least, all those ideas, that would be anyone. That would be everyone. That would be all of us. That would be anyone who knows that they are destined to die. That's who that is. And now, we read this text in Matthew, and it just sounds like Jesus is reneging on everything that he said in the parables. Like he's just taking it all back. It's like he's saying, yes, I want to seek the lost of this world, the way a crazy good shepherd would, that would seek out his lost sheep, but I'm not planning to overdo it. What I really meant was that you should give the lost sheep in your world, you should give the people that sin against you, exactly and only three shots at getting found, and if they don't make it under that wire, you just tell them tough luck and you punt them out of the fold. Once personally, once with a witness, once with the community as a witness, that's how the text reads. right? We just read it. Did I miss something? So there's the shiny thing. The shiny thing is that the plausible way to handle whatever comes up in our lives that requires forgiveness could be understood that way from this text. And it's on that reading of this text that the Christian church has had a 2,000-year-old love affair with excommunication. For basically running the last lost and least off, you know, the Good Shepherd's ranch. But here's the dilemma. That reading of that text totally turfs out the parable that comes right before the text, and it does the same to the parable that comes right after the text, which we're going to get to in a couple of weeks. So, to cut to the chase of what's going on here, let's consider Jesus' use of the phrase, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector, because that's the summation of, if the three strikes don't work, this is how you should behave, okay? So this is how you should treat that person. And I'm going to do something that I don't do here very often. I'm going to offer kind of a primer on digging for meaning in a biblical text, on exegesis. You know, it's kind of a technical thing, and most of us have been exposed to this at some point, but it's going to be very much at the primer level, so if you're actually a student of exegesis, forgive the gloss. But I don't want to get technical for technical's sake. For lots of folks, the only fair way to get at what Jesus might have meant by a phrase like, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector, the only kind of fair way to get at what that might have meant would be to ask the question, what would an average Jew living in Jesus' time have understood that phrase to mean? Right? It's a very common technique in trying to say, how are we going to understand this sacred text of ours? How are we going to make meaning from this? And under that approach, the conclusion that's generally reached by people is that the people all around Jesus would have thought, when they thought about treat him like a Gentile and a tax collector, they would have thought outcast. Treat that person as an outcast. So three strikes and you get cast out. That's how the text reads when you use that kind of an approach to exegeting it, right? But there are at least three problems with that reading. First of all, Jesus has just finished talking about actively seeking outcasts, not giving them the boot. He's just been hammering away at this in the parables of Matthew. So even if he was thinking outcast when he said Gentiles and tax collector, he wasn't thinking shunning, he was thinking seeking. It's just the complete opposite. And furthermore, I think we could make a reasonable case by this point in the story for Jesus not being an average Jew. In fact, he's not even an average Messiah. He's done all these things to disqualify himself from Messiahship right out of the chute. He's put himself outside of the Messiah box so decidedly by this point in the story that there's just nothing average about the way he's looking at the narrative from the inside as a Jew and as a candidate for Messiahship. What he's already said and acted out about his ideas about acceptance versus rejection, not to mention that in the parable of the lost coin, he's pronounced the death of religion, suggests that his take on who is in and who is out is pretty nearly inside out and backwards to the prevailing one. That it's pretty much upside down. And finally, one of my friends, I went to an undergraduate institution that has a sign by the road leading in that says, the word of our God shall stand forever. And one of my colleagues, subsequently also a student from that institution as an undergraduate, said, I think they left off the S. They should have said, the words of our God will stand together. That there's kind of this overcommitment to the text as text. So who says that when we're seeking meaning in the text, we only deal with what was said? How about what was done? How about what was acted out? Because in the end, this whole idea of living in the way of Jesus is actually an acted idea. It's actually about saying, well, what would I live like in this situation? What would we act like? What are we going to do next Sunday when Old Testament prophet guy goes off his nut and starts shouting gloom and doom and the children are hiding under the pews and we don't know what to do next? Right? It's kind of acted. And that's in a religious context, but we're going to walk out of here tonight and there's going to be half a dozen people in the parking lot that really need a safe place, and we're going to have questions in our head about acting too. You know, like, I mean, it's just all around us. So those are just proximate examples. So what did Jesus do? Well, context, who did Jesus hang around with? Well, when the religious leaders were pissed at Jesus, why? Why were they feeling that way? Well, because he insisted on hanging out with, quote, I think it was in Galatians, the sinners of the Gentiles and tax collectors. That's a curious kind of alignment, isn't it? So, what's going on in this text? This is a cherished defense for what amounts to ultimately unforgiveness in the church. So what's going on? Well, personally, I think this is almost funny. If it wasn't for the damage that has accrued over the centuries, then in the 21st century, wrestling with this text, we would miss it, because I think what's going on in this text is irony. We so care about our irony, you know. We have variations of irony that we're proud to work with in our age. Jesus is capable of the full range of human expression, and somehow we just want to kind of sanitize everything. And when we do that, I think we kind of lose our imagination about the text. Think about it this way. Jesus has been hammering away at lastness, lostness, leastness, and death, and he knows the disciples really aren't getting it. They're just not clicking in. And so he decides to take a completely different tact. So he follows up, he's just told this story about this truly indefatigable seeker of the lost, this shepherd who would risk everything for one stray and who would do the same thing if they all strayed off while he was looking for the one stray. And it's just like this over-the-top story about the crazy commitment of this shepherd to seeking the lost. He's just finished telling this story. The disciples don't get it. And so it's kind of like, well, maybe what I need to do is I need to follow that story with a set of rules for forgiveness that fly in the face of everything that I've just been saying. And then when the disciples think that through and find it a bit too harsh and suggest a compromise, we'll see where that goes. We'll see if maybe then we have a chance to talk about the actual size of this idea of forgiveness. So here's a short, not very creative, because this isn't my forte, short imaginary dialogue between Jesus and the disciples. So Jesus is sort of wrapping up the story. So Jesus, so the shepherd seeks the lost sheep unconditionally. Disciple, you know, you don't really mean that as practical advice. Like, you don't actually mean we should do that. And Jesus says, oh, okay, let me make it practical. Forget the first story. The shepherd in the new parable gives the stupid sheep three chances to get found, and then he gives up on it. And the disciple, if there were stage directions, the disciple, brackets, mental wheels turning, calculating how many chances they would need before they got dropped, close bracket. That sounds maybe just a little tougher than you meant to be. How about he gives the sheep seven chances? At which point Jesus springs a trap and says, how about 70 times seven? See the problem? You thought I didn't really mean unconditionally, but I did. I did. I actually meant it. Which leads us right into the parable of the unforgiving servant, which we're going to save for another time. Maybe it comes down to plausibility again. Maybe we just really find it hard to believe that when Jesus tries to help those who wish to walk in his way understand just how good God is, it just feels like a huge stretch. We just can't reach that far. There's lots of reasons why that might be true. Just like, why isn't this more normal? It's a complicated thing. But one of the things that possibility does is it takes negative fear as a motivator right out of the picture. And it promptly leads us in the direction of love. Because think about it. If we can't actually do anything to qualify for forgiveness, why do anything good? Why walk in the way of Jesus at all? If it's not going to save our sorry butts from, you know, fiery demise, why make the effort? Really? You want to look like Zoe walking around with that tube on your eye looking for God? Because seeking God in a culture where it might not be the norm in any given moment can be kind of odd. I thought that was one of the most lovely things I'd ever heard. But anyways, odd for sure when you try to picture it as a metaphor in lived life, right? So why bother? Well, at the end of all of the nuanced possible answers to that, we end ourselves up around the thing called love. Like, really, the reason to walk in the way of Jesus is love. Not saving ourselves from destruction, because we can't. And that's what the parables of grace, say, over and over and over again. Not only can you not do it, but you needn't. There's no qualifying round. There's no eliminations. There's no some in, some are out. In terms of qualifying, everybody's in. And that's worth thinking about. It is, as one of my friends says about becoming married and subsequently becoming a parent, one of those ordinary things that only changes everything. And it's just this idea that Jesus keeps working with and working with and working with that can get to sound ordinary grace, in a religious setting anyway. Oh yeah, grace, yeah, good. I like it. Good thing it's there. You didn't think I was serious, did you? I actually meant it. Jesus is saying in this complicated, ironic text. And if you don't think I mean it, just weigh yourself against the three strikes and you're out thing. And see which thing you think I'm talking about. The disciples couldn't even stomach. The disciples who weren't getting it couldn't even stomach the idea of three strikes and you're out, because they knew, I would propose, that they'd be out. So arguably, you know, Jesus made some progress here with them and perhaps with us. At any rate, we can let that rumble around, see where it takes us. And next week we'll go to some other countries and cultures and dilemmas of another kind, perhaps, as well. Yeah. See where that takes us.
In some ways it's fitting to what you're talking about, stories of forgiveness.
Yeah.
And people overcoming. I was in Nigeria and Bosnia a few months ago, so stories of peacemakers that I met and the stories they have of that overcoming forgiveness.
Costly
having
stories.
No reason to forgive and yet they've chosen to.
Heard an interview today with the woman who 36 years ago, would this be now, 37 years ago, as a 13-year-old, was the girl that was raped by Roman Polanski, a renowned film director. And her story, and story of forgiveness as well. Very powerful story. So this is everywhere. This is not, we've been talking about Jesus' parable of it, but this is the stuff of life, you know. So we need to ruminate on it. And not as ideas, although that's certainly fine, but as lived life. Because the implications of this are gargantuan. They're huge, you know, and encompassing. All right, I'm going to be quiet now. Peace.